just gonna laugh. So I guess my first question is, how did you folks come to have the building in the first place?
Come to what?
How did you folks come to the building in the first place?
Oh. Well, you start.
Okay. Have you ever heard of the Sunday Suppers? Maybe not. It's a weekly meal.
At St. Andrews?
Yes, I
served for about a year and a half. St. Andrews is my home church, actually.
Oh, okay. Yep. So we were at the Sunday Suppers starting around 1988.
Okay.
And I guess among the core volunteers, it was back in the day when there weren't a lot of supports for, not that there are a lot now, but for the marginalized. There was no nursing service, there were no street navigators, there were, other than some extremely awesome social workers. There wasn't a lot of the day-by-day coming alongside as much as there is now. So we found ourselves going to doctor's appointments with the community that we knew through the Sunday Suppers. We'd go to doctor's appointments, we'd go visit out of jail, we would, help them with transportation. There were just a lot of the day-by-day things. And so among the leadership, we thought, wouldn't it be great if we had like a drop-in center during the week? And we started looking, and 2177 was on the market. And in the process of looking, Dorothy was part of the leadership group at the Sunday Suppers. It became more and more her focus that it was the youth who were really falling through the cracks. So we kind of refined the vision from a drop-in for everybody to a drop-in for street-affected youth and the travelers. And so, around, I guess it was early 2000s, the drop-in started. And we've been involved with it really from the get-go.
Dorothy basically ran it.
She totally ran it, but we've supported them financially, and I cooked there once
and
a week. I was like an errand person. If somebody needed to go to the dentist, or if he would call me, and I would do that. So we were on the periphery of just helping and supporting.
And being people's support system.
Yeah, Dorothy's support system, basically. Yeah. Yeah. And it was an awesome community.
So what's your background, Mary?
My background, I was born in the U.S. I was born in Pennsylvania, and lived a very protected, privileged life, just being honest. And met Wally. I was at nursing school, and he was in medical school, and we met, and kind of thought we were off to just, a shallow, kind of dream come true. And then he was in C. We went to Tennessee, and he was at CBC, and we both had a faith experience. And the very first thing that happened after I had this faith experience was I went to volunteer at an all-night shelter in Atlanta. That just changed my life. I just had lived so protected. Just had no idea what was going on around me. And shortly thereafter, we moved up here, and driving down Brunswick Street, one day I saw Hope Cottage. It was like, I just knew, you know.
Had to be involved in some
had
way.
To be involved. It wasn't like, it was terrifying to me, but it just was something in my heart that I couldn't not recognize. And after Hope Cottage, then came Sunday Suppers. And just a very different, deeper, extraordinary, wonderful life that we've had knowing people outside our shallow existence.
I mean, the Sunday Suppers, basically, Mary felt that the call that said, you know, when you give a party, don't give it to your friends. This is from the script, you know, don't give it to your friends.
How Sunday Suppers
yeah,
started.
Yeah, and so we had a party on Christmas Eve in, what, 1980?
At St. Andrews.
And it was such a success, and all the church people were involved, and our friends, and people came in, we had a great meal, we had music, and so then you said, we should do this every week. And it turned into an every week foundation. People came together and it worked out.
It's caused us to live a very different life.
Yeah,
and to reevaluate our faith in ways that we had to learn to break away and trust our hearts.
I spent about a year doing that every week, and they still tell that story of the first.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
To the volunteers, the new volunteers every week.
Yeah. Oh, that's. I guess they do. And, yeah, that's right. I remember that.
I've heard Diane tell that story probably.
Oh,
yeah. At least 40, 50 times now.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure.
And.
It really happened.
Yeah. I kind of saw it as spiritually radicalizing, almost. It really put some spirit behind it.
Yeah, it sort of takes being St. Andrews as a South End church to say, look, folks, we got to do more than that, right?
I think that bridge was crossed in 1988.
Yeah.
You know, St. Andrews has always been hugely, hugely 1985, yeah. I'm sorry, that's when it was, has been hugely supportive of the Sunday Suppers. The thing about the Suppers that I love is it's a very tender community. And Henry Nouwen uses an expression. He says, whenever there are people that get together and care about each other, and if you're on the outside looking in, it doesn't make sense why these people are together, loving. And I feel like the Sunday Suppers is a beloved community. It's just based on tenderness. And when I think of the people who rub shoulders there, it's just... care about each other. It's kind of a miracle.
And so,
I mean, it's so real.
Yeah. And so, Ark and Dorothy and the drop-in came out of that. And it was actually part of the same organization. I think the Suppers and Ark.
For a long time.
Yeah. Mm. But that's how the drop-in started.
I'm glad you understand.
Yeah, because you've been there.
Really
so.
Glad and you understand, because sometimes it's hard to explain to people.
In all honesty, that was kind of hard to hear. I had to stop serving because I felt unsafe there, actually.
No, and I understand why you might.
As something that I had built into my, really part of my practice, is that a number of incidences have led to personally feeling attacked by guests and undefended by the people there.
Oh, I'm really sorry.
So to feel that where you speak about walking around and seeing the inside of that, I'm like, that can only go so far sometimes. But
I am so sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, I was.
Because for me, like you being attacked, that would be a hill I'd be willing to die on.
Yeah,
I think it's Kathy. Do you know Kathy McKay was running it?
Absolutely,
now.
No.
Kathy feels the same way.
I approach it with the most love because it is only. It was something that happened from them being entirely overwhelmed. And it was at a point in the heat of the summer trying to do more numbers than we've ever done before there.
Yes.
You know, we were at that point, we were breaking 300 a week.
Yeah.
And something broke in that. I found something, whether it was, I'm not sure, but there was a lack of the there wasn't enough of us to go around and show enough care that we lost control of the situation.
Do you know, COVID really kind of works in this sense.
Yeah.
COVID, the whole...
The dynamic changed.
We used to come together. Everybody would eat together. Everybody sitting down at a table eating together, and often there'd be as many volunteers as there were guests. Mm-hmm. And then COVID, I came in COVID I could only be in, my kids were so upset with me for being over 70. You know, just mom can't go. And I found even just being in the back, I would come out. And it's very hard to not hug or get nose to nose. So,
but being able to keep going at all was
amazing. And now there's they're still doing amazing work. But and they're trying to respond to what people want. But half the people just won't take it.
Yeah, they just come and take out.
And that is half the people they don't even know. We used to know 95% of the people who were there. Mm-hmm. See, these are the dynamics that have changed because of COVID. It's become much more rule-driven, and you know, it is what it is, but it's still, I'm so sorry you had that experience. Mm-hmm.
It was honestly one of the hardest things I've experienced in a long time. I was unable to speak for about a week. Yeah, I was. I was shouted at and by a guest so loud that everyone in that hall heard and accused me of what should at this point no longer hurt. Yeah, I hear that. But the fact that she was literally stood up from a conversation with Diane and was not stopped. And I finished serving an entire tray of chips while this verbal abuse was in the hall loud enough for everyone to hear, which was not stopped. I finished, I went back, and I cried, and I thought she would be gone 20 minutes later, and that guest was still there in that same conversation, not asked to leave, nothing. And that was my breaking point.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think they don't have as many volunteers. And I think there may be a reason for that. I think a lot of the non-core volunteers who show up get overwhelmed by it. Because as you said, like if you can't have that big spiritual experience of going through that and really understanding it, it can just fry you and exhaust you if you don't have the other half of it.
And if you don't have the entire, like a large core community. interacting on all sorts of issues, but looking out for your back, it's just not.
And I still walk down Spring Garden. I'm a very identifiable person. And I still have guests come up to me, ask, you know, see how I'm doing, ask, and the ones, and it was still that real connection. And now, when they need something, and they still like see me, like, hey, can you set me up with a pair of shoes or a jacket, and, you know, like.
Have you talked with any of the? I'm retired, so I would, you know, I would feel, I feel like they need to hear the story too, and apologize to you and do something to.
I have had my discussions with Patricia and Susan at St. Andrews, and I do not, but I have, no one from Sunday Suppers even reached out to see if I was okay. And they had been emailing me every month for a week. They knew how to reach me. No one even reached out to ask if I was okay. After I left, I looked them in the eye, I looked Kathy and Martin in the eye and said, I will not be back. And walked out the door, and no one ever followed up and asked if I was okay. The only discussions I've had are when I took it to the administration of the church, who I'm close to. I still go and clean up their donations on the stage every day and organize that, but I can't be around the guests. I can't be around them. I don't feel safe, but like, and that's how they treat their volunteers now. And like, I know a lot of students who show up. They feel a little used by it too. Mm. And I think it's because the people running it are overwhelmed. And obviously they are the sweetest, kindest, most, but balls are dropping. I did not mean to make this about me.
That's okay. That's good to hear.
I feel like it's always about all
of us. I was just so surprised when you even brought the topic up that it was like, oh, this is supposed to be here. Which is.
On behalf of Sunday Suppers.
No, which I
used to be a part of for 30 years.
Yeah.
And
like I said, I'm not. I do what I can still. I organize the donations on the stage and do all that stuff. And I just.
That's an awesome help to them.
But.
You have to feel safe and
it was that nobody reached out. Over a year of me there every week. Yeah. So
Mary would have reached out. She wasn't involved then.
No problem. So let's get off of that. Because that's let's talk about you.
Okay.
So you're at the CDC, huh? That's big.
So I trained in internal medicine, and I trained in infectious disease at Vanderbilt, and so started to round out my infectious disease experience. I went to through a friend at Vanderbilt who said, "Gee, you need to do this program. It's called the Epidemic Intelligence Service." And if you've ever seen any of the movies on TV about outbreaks and things like that, there's always someone from CDC that's sort of sent to investigate. So I was one of those individuals sent to investigate various outbreaks. So I was at CDC, and it's a two-year program. I was at CDC from, I guess it was 1980 to 82, and there are big things happening around the country at that point in time, one of which was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, and a number of my friends and colleagues were actually there are four of them put into a task force to study this new disease that seemed to be affecting gay men, and no one knew what, we didn't know it was a virus then or anything, but so they began to study it. I was in a different branch, but I was watching all that was going on, so I did they sent me on an outbreak investigation in the Maritimes for a disease called listeriosis or listeria, and a was affecting a lot of the babies born at IWK and stuff. And so I was sent up, I think I spent 7 weeks up here and sort of tracing where this outbreak was from. In fact, it was the first foodborne outbreak that had been documented in Listeria. And everybody knows now that Listeria you get from eating deli meats and things like that. But at that time, we didn't know it was foodborne. So anyway, so I did the investigation. But in the meantime, I'd met a lot of the, there was one infectious disease person who became our dean, actually, Tom Mary, who was the only infectious disease. He said, well, would you, because I was looking for an academic position. And said, would you consider coming to Canada? I said, sure. Anyway, so. So he made me, you know, I brought Mary up to see it, and she's sort of a New England girl, so, you know, the climate was familiar and everything. And I took the job as an assistant professor at Dow in the Department of Medicine, and sort of the second person in this two-man division. And of course, at that time, that was 82, you know, we still didn't know what caused AIDS, I saw two people in Halifax who met the case definition for AIDS that they were looking at, they were both quite ill and both ultimately died, I saw that, and then of course we started to see more cases that met the case definition, and then we found the virus and all of that happened. And then, then as we got more cases, we decided we'd set up a special clinic, you know, to deal with this thing. And so I started that clinic, and you know, we did eventually, more people came on board, Dr. David Haas and Dr. Lynn Johnson, and so now there are four of us, and some of us worked in the, Tom didn't, I don't think, but the rest of us worked in the HIV clinic, and saw patients, and of course at that time it was before we had treatment, really, and so unfortunately we were sort of shepherding a lot of people to their death. Some of which involved being admitted to hospital, and because these individuals' immune systems were compromised, we would tend to admit them on the eighth floor of the VG. It wasn't an AIDS ward, it was a ward for leukemia and lymphoma, people getting chemotherapy and stuff, but it was the appropriate place to hospitalize people who needed to be hospitalized. So we set that up, and because, you know, AIDS was beginning to affect people all over Canada, Montreal, Vancouver, Toronto, you know, committees were formed, and I was sort of a maritime rep, I guess, from the National Advisory Committee for AIDS and other things. And I was also appointed to one of the national advisory committees at CDC in Atlanta, so I used to go down there. And, you know, we were developing policies and looking at what was happening with the epidemic and everything. And then we started to try some therapies. AZT was the first drug that became available. Had a few patients on that. They seemed to improve a little bit, but then ultimately died. And it was really not until 1996 at the Vancouver AIDS meeting that a paper was presented, called the Merck 035 study, and it was a paper that looked at a combination of two of the drugs plus a protease inhibitor, which is another class of drug, and it turned out that actually patients did well, their T cells recovered. They didn't have all the illnesses that they would be prone to if they had AIDS. And so that was a real turning point. And we actually saw the death rates going down. And so my patients in the clinic, and everyone started to feel better. We get patients who are taking drugs. And I still see an occasional patient on the street now that I knew 25 years ago, you know, that came in ill with HIV and are now still doing fine. As long as you take your medications, you know, they do very well.
It's not a world I thought I'd see growing up.
No, I'm sure. Yeah. So that was sort of how I got involved, and it was, you know, it basically pretty much made my career out of that.
And, it defined your career.
What's that?
It defined.
Yeah, I would say it defined that plus the Listeria outbreak, but it sort of defined my career. I expected. Yeah. So.
That's, I had a lot of friends and family go through that at the time.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Like, my mother has spent a lot of time in hospitals over the years.
Yeah.
She described it like going to the moon.
Really?
Up there. Like,
yeah.
Just the quality of, like, how did you balance that, like, quality of life versus just trying to...
The quality of my life?
No, everybody involved.
Yeah. I think, well, you know, there were a lot of unknowns to begin with. And so, you know, people were cautious about contacting patients and stuff. But the science tells us that, you know, there's no issues with hugging a person or kissing a person or coming into physical contact with someone with HIV, even if they're not on therapy. So that, you know, took a little time and education to just become a little more relaxed around that. The same with Ebola, you know.
I know, certainly I remember hearing stories from bigger hospitals like New York and stuff. Did you have issues staffing the ward?
I don't recall any issues staffing the ward. There might have been one or two nurses who were uncomfortable and requested transfer. You know, I don't recall any specifics, but I seem to recall there was some hesitancy on the part of them, so they would make accommodation. But most of the people that spent a lot of time up there were very dedicated to dealing with this, who were unafraid and not, you know, not really worried about, you know, acquiring infection or something like that. You know, as long as you were careful, didn't jab needles in your hand and things like that, you would be okay. So.
Always great to hear when people don't give in to fear.
Yeah.
You used to take the kids?
Yeah, I'd take the kids to visit some of my patients and introduce them. And so that, you know, and again, I didn't do it specifically as an example to others, but I did it because I enjoyed my patients and I thought they might want to meet some of my kids, you know. So it would be, you know, that was the motivation. I wasn't trying to be, say, look, if I bring my kids, then you don't need to be afraid or something like that. But
the whole Princess Di of it all.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. So I, you know, yeah, so we kids, Mary would visit on occasion. And so.
I remember, I think it, Wally believes in the science of things, which I think is kind of important today. We seem to be losing that as a society. But there was a fellow who was, we were very close to, who had HIV, and it was before the drugs came out. It was in the early 90s, and he was visiting. It was the last time, actually, he was well enough to visit. And he came to our house, and he was sitting in the chair. And I
we got to know him before, yeah.
He was sitting there in the chair having soda, and my 2.5-year-old son, the baby of the family who adored this guy, came up to him and said, "Can I have a bit of your soda?" And I looked at me and I thought, this is it. Do I believe Wally? what I believe in. And you know, I just nodded and go ahead, take a sip.
So he would sit on his lap. And,
yeah, you know, he just so. And then that same visit, I don't know the connection, Mikey came up and gave him a hug that lasted so long. His eyes and my eyes were what's going on. After that hug, I said, well, you don't get a lot of those in your life. Just absolute love. I had no conditions. It came from the heart. This little
Yeah, and he passed away shortly thereafter, but left us a beautiful painting that he got in Mexico. We still have that hanging.
Fantastic.
Yeah, there are people we were very close to. And
you, did you meet Bob? And when did Bob come
into it? Oh, Bob.
I was just
about
to ask that. That was the next on the list.
Okay, no, Bob.
I was wondering how you and Bob.
No, well, Bob, I mean, when we started the clinic, and it turns out many of the patients referred to the clinic were from Bob's practice. So Bob had a practice. The majority probably of the people, the early HIV infected individuals, had him as their physician. So we became close because we were managing the same patients. We were going to the same meetings about, you know, policy in Nova Scotia or hospital things. And so we got to know each other pretty well during that time. Bob eventually retired, I think, from his practice. So actually he was working over at Dartmouth. So we haven't seen a lot of each other over the last few years and stuff. But he was really the AIDS doctor from a general practitioner point of view in Halifax. Halifax was a little bit different than Toronto and Vancouver in terms of the approach to HIV. Most of the HIV care here was done by specialists, whereas in Toronto, for example, or Vancouver, the GPs really took on that role. Bob was the only one here who sort of took on that management role here, and he and I would collaborate on best practices for his patients and, of course, for the other patients as well, too. So.
Quite a career.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, no, I've been blessed. I also, when I got a little older, and I'll tell you this frankly, HIV became more like diabetes. You know, if you take your drugs, you know, you're feeling well, and I sort of missed a little bit of the front line kind of sick patient management and stuff. So I took a sabbatical in 2003 and I went to Africa for 3 months to teach HIV medicine and work on wards there, followed by 3 months in India doing the same thing. So it was a 6-month sabbatical.
Very much back to the front lines. Just
And you know, the first time I walked into that ward in Kampala Malago Hospital, I mean, tears are right there. I mean, the human misery was unbelievable. So I got involved there and helped set up a brand new clinic right next to the hospital for HIV. And I've been going back to Africa. I only went the one trip to India, but going back to Africa for 15 years. I haven't been back in there. I went last year briefly, but I haven't been back as regularly as I used to go and watch things develop. And in fact, the last time I was back last year, looking at everybody who comes to the clinic gets registered sequentially. And so they were well over their 40,000th patient in this one clinic. I'm not saying they're probably actively managing 10,000, but there are 4 other clinics on what we call Malago Hill in Kampala,
managing similar volumes of patients. So we have no idea here the impact in Africa. And when the drugs came along, because I was there before the drugs, again, it changed lives. And the PEPFAR program, which you probably heard about, has changed lives. Mm-hmm. And of course, now we're facing with that.
It's going to go bad.
That clown down in Washington facing, you know, possible termination of that program, which should be very sad. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So. Anyway, so that's been a large part of my in the last. So I went sort of halftime at Dow and done that, and now I'm almost completely retired. I do a little hospitalist work now, you know, a week here and there, just to keep my oar in the water. I enjoy patient contact, and so I like to see patients. But these are mostly elderly people waiting for nursing homes. So I'm not really involved in the HIV AIDS stuff, except when I go overseas. But here it's sort of, again, evolved into sort of a different experience, I'd say. So anyway, yeah, that's my story. So.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. What a lot. I guess.
Don't check the receipt. No, go ahead. Yeah.
Double check we're still recording. Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Dan wanted me to ask you how the year's been so kind to either of you, because you put in quite a long career and you still seem to have a lot of energy and output to give. So, any secrets?
How we keep
our kids, grandkids, kids keep us.
Right now, a lot of our energies are going to back to family, to grandchildren. And
got 14, going up 15.
Ah, oh.
A few of those, and most of them are in the States, so we're doing a lot of traveling to visit. Although my daughter actually bought our house on Cherry Street, so she's living here with her husband there too. And we have another son who just moved back from LA to Toronto. So we have two of the five kids in this country now. So.
What was the question?
How we stay?
What motivates us?
I was not exactly sure about his motivation with that question, honestly.
Yeah,
I just,
fair enough.
He left me on the end of the list, so. Yeah, I think I have everything I need, actually.
Okay.
That's fantastic. Did you have anything else to kind of put a button on your life or how you got involved with all of this?
We just love the people we've met through that story.
Yeah.
It's a vibrant, caring community, and we're so happy to just have a little pinky finger in the corner of, you know, helping you be you.
Yeah.
You guys do what you do, and to...
And I think you know, we really wanted to see Radstorm remain downtown, in a community.
That's changed,
but you know, there's still a core there, and so you know, they wanted to buy the building, and we'd much rather sell it to them than to a developer or something. So Bob Fredrickson's going to be a big part of that. So, and that's
very grateful for him.
Grateful for his, and I guess the city council is going to put some money up. And anyway, so we're excited.
One question I think did have for you in all of this, where you were on kind of on my side of the things with the on the side of science, fighting AIDS the whole time.
Yeah.
How did you see the other side, the cultural fight, the how art and protests and the whole movement towards...
Like ACT UP and some of the other things.
AIDS quilts.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it had to happen because government was... And not just government, but sort of administration and the society as whole was really moving like molasses, I think, ultimately to the right, you know, I don't mean to the right, but I mean to the right conclusion. And so it's been gratifying to see, but it was slow, and so they needed, you know, the protests and stuff like that. I don't think I would have, you know, thrown paint on Tony Fauci when he was, you know, when ACT UP was at him.
Well, what you did do was went out and talked to people.
Yeah.
He would go and talk to groups who would, you know, come tell us, I want to know about HIV AIDS. He, after he went to Africa, he put a presentation together because he felt like Africa was just numbers. So he put faces to it and he called it Faces of AIDS. He asked people permission there to take a picture of your face.
Yeah.
And he would...
Just to get away from the whole numbers game.
Yeah, because... Yeah,
and that these aren't... It's not... Yeah. These are like
those
weird...
Those are astronomical numbers.
Yeah,
yes.
And it's interesting, I gave a talk at Acadia, and I gave a presentation, and my co-presenter was Stephen Lewis, and I gave my presentation, and he cried, so I mean, it was interesting.
That's quite a claim.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a fantastic talk to you.
Get us off the record.